Welcome, I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and this is a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Thank you for joining us for a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast on Mental Health News Radio Network. This podcast is also available wherever you get your podcasts, but I do suggest checking out Mental Health News Radio Network to find all your podcasts related to mental health. Today's guest is Steve Wilson. Steve is the author of Teetering on a Tightrope, My Bipolar Journey. Steve has helped over 1,000 people facilitating mental health programs and raising awareness on mental health and the inadequacy of government programs and the damage done by insurance companies when providing mental health care. Steve, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lorelei. Nice to be here.
You know, of all the trauma, the episodes I haven't spoken to anyone. Well, I'm sure there are people who had been diagnosed with bipolar who have been on my podcast, but we haven't actually talked about it. I've talked about my journey. I actually was diagnosed bipolar about 15 years ago, a little less than that. It was a misdiagnosis because then 10 years after that, I actually realized that it was PTSD. And so that's kind of my story. But I did the whole, you know, the medication with the lithium and changing my medications. But I wanted to ask about your journey in living with bipolar disorder.
Okay. I'll tell you one thing. I was misdiagnosed at the beginning, too.
Oh, really?
And I was misdiagnosed for 8 years. So I'm in the same ballpark you're in. My dive into bipolar really started when I was 9 years old. I was raped by someone unknown to me, in a movie theater restroom. I blamed myself. I didn't know what the hell to think. I never even knew that kind of stuff could happen.
Yeah. At nine, who would?
Yeah. And so I decided not to tell anybody ever. And I didn't for 30 years. Now, there is no positive proof that bipolar comes from an incident like I suffered, or it's genetic, or it's both. From my looking into my past, my family's past, I've had a guy who hanged himself in a barn and a woman who was institutionalized for 20 years. So there might be some proof that it's in my family, but there's no way to really prove it. I suffered throughout junior high school, high school. I put on a facade all my early years. I was very popular, did sports, got good grades. But on the inside, I was hurting. I couldn't sleep. Felt no one loved me, and I didn't really have any feelings for anybody else. When I try to describe what it's like to be suicidal, people can't understand the feeling that I had or that other people have because it is terrible. I lost control of my mind. The suicidal ideations were so bad, and my mind kept telling me to kill myself, and I couldn't stop it. But I did not try to kill myself. Went through high school and went through college. And when I got out for college, because of my bipolar, I had not been able to really hunker down and learn much in college. I just kind of skated through. And then I never got along with my father. So one day we were having a barbecue in the backyard and he pissed me off and we got in an altercation. And the next day I woke up in a mental institution. I was there for 3 weeks. Got let out, was, and at that time they gave me the diagnosis as clinical depression. And that was wrong. And for the next 8 years, I tried every medication, and there weren't many. Remember, this is 1970. And I raped in 1958, so there weren't many medications. There were a handful, and they all made me sick. So I went through the next 8 years in terrible shape. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't do anything, couldn't sleep. All I did at night was sit in front of the TV. I would correlate it to kind of like video games today, but that's what the TV was back then. I just sit there and get through the night somehow. That was 1970. In 1978, my psychiatrist came in the room and said, "I think I made a mistake. You're bipolar." I said, "What in the hell is bipolar?" And he said, "Let's try lithium." And it worked very well for me. It got me about halfway back, but at least I was able to function. And I got through life pretty well after that, but had a lot of I would guess you'd call ruminations, where my mind would be out of control, and if I've said something bad to somebody, or at least that I felt it was bad, I would worry about it for days and days until I took care of it. And that's what went on for many years. And then in about 2000, my psychiatrist said, "I've got a new pill that might help your ruminations." It was Paxil, and it made me a hell of a lot better. Now, when I say a hell of a lot better, I mean I didn't have a lot of problems, but some of the ruminations continued. One problem I had was that I always had to please anybody, and I could not stand up for myself, and that continued, and that played havoc with my work. So that's it. Today I'm pretty damn good. I facilitate two mental health support groups here in Phoenix, and that's really opened my eyes to what people go through who have no way of getting help simply because they can't afford it. And they get government assistance, which is nice, but it isn't very much. And they go into clinics and they get so-so care because that's all they can afford. The insurance companies have made it so restrictive to pay out anything for mental care, and they cut down their payments to the psychiatrists and therapists. So they have to jack up their prices. And then anybody making less than about $75,000 or $100,000 a year today has a tough time affording good care.
Mental health care, it is very frustrating, in that it's just so costly, right? And most mental health care providers, at least the ones that I've have and the ones that I've provided some folks, they're out of network. You have to pay out of pocket, and then submitting to insurance, I mean, good luck. And so that really turns people off in wanting to get the health care, mental health care they need, which, truth be told, like, mental health care is should be integrated with, health care. It is health care. And I know that that's extremely frustrating for most folks who are trying, who know they need the help, but they're just not getting there. You did talk about, it was the misdiagnosis, and then, you were on the lithium and then the Paxil. And I want to get back to healthcare in a little bit, but I do want to ask, when was, like, the turning point where everything felt like it was stable?
When I got the lithium, and then finished up with a Paxil. I got the first help from being in the hospital. But when I got out, I was still all screwed up. And for those 8 years, I was going to be a golf pro in a club setting, not as a player. And had a great job out here in Scottsdale. Couldn't handle it. Couldn't do anything. And that's what went on for those 8 years. And then that's when I got the lithium. And then that's when everything opened up. Two, people got to understand there is no magic bullet that's going to cure you for most of these mental health issues. And so I was with the lithium, I was in good shape, but I still had a lot of problems. I spent money, and I wasn't manic. The reason I spent money and did things is because I just couldn't function in a normal way. So I viewed money as something to spend. And then the Paxil got me over the top, as I said before. I got married in 1972. I've been married to the same woman for 51 years. I had three daughters. And so I had some good things going for me.
When was it when you decided that you were going to write your memoir, Teetering on a Tightrope?
Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was still having some problems with things that had gone on in the past. Nothing illegal, but mental problems, such as a woman who I had an affair with back in the 70s or late 60s. I couldn't get her out of my mind. And I think about it all the time. Didn't want to have a relationship with her, but it just drove me nuts. So in that, plus the rape, I went to a trauma therapist. And she suggested that we go through my life, starting with when I was 8, right before the rape, and go through my whole life. And we spent, 10 months doing that. And when we got all done, I felt a big relief. The trauma therapy really worked. It was wonderful. And she said, you know, you got so much shit going on in that life of yours. Why don't you write a book?
Yeah.
And she was kind of just joking. I had been a sports writer in my early years, so I knew a little bit about writing. And it was fairly easy because I knew what the whole content was going to be because I'd lived through it.
Right.
So it wasn't that difficult, but no matter what, it's a very long process.
Now, how was the process besides being long? Was it emotionally draining?
No. That was not because, and I tell you, the only reason is because I went through that trauma therapist and everything just kind of smoothed out. The process in length is writing it well enough that so that people will read it. That took a year. And then it is very difficult to get them published. So I had to go self-publishing. And that took another year and a half. So it's a long process.
Did you, in writing, and I think it's fascinating, you sought out a trauma therapist. Was there a specific modality that she focused on? What kind of work did you do with this trauma therapist? Was it talk?
We simply had one-on-one conversations, wrote everything down. And then she kind of summarized it at the end. There are a lot of modalities that people use these days. There's CBD, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. There's EMDR. And they're very good therapies. They help people a hell of a lot. And I never had to do it because it wasn't around back when I was all messed
Yeah.
up. Problem is, for people who are going through government-assisted programs, they know very little about those offerings, so they don't get the help. And then the ones of us who are capable of paying, it can be very expensive, so they don't
Yeah.
do it. I want to tell something about the government assistance here while I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, please.
It takes in the United States $100,000, around that, a year or more to have a fairly comfortable life. The government, in its wonderfulness, has disability insurance, and they pay the recipients $16,000 a year. And if the recipients make some money on the side and it reaches over $20,000 a year, the government cuts them off. So the poor people who have no other way to get help live in the danger of getting a job to better themselves, and the fear of losing their insurance, losing their privileges to get mental health and their medication. So while the government touts all the help they give everybody, it's very lacking.
Yeah, there's not much you can do with $20,000 nowadays. If you cap out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and that is frustrating. And that's, the we the government, want to focus. They say they want to focus on mental health, but it really needs to start with insurance and access. And like you were saying, these modalities, and these are modalities that were extremely important to my recovery. I didn't know anything about them. I was put on some, SSRIs, antidepressants. I was on lithium for 10 years, almost like 5 years, and then I switched up to another medication. But then it was. Then when I was extremely suicidal. It was my fifth suicide attempt, and my last one back in 2020, early 2020, in February. And I had to go to a mental health facility, actually, in Tucson, Arizona, Sierra Tucson. And they had all these modalities that I had never even heard of. And still finding those, and I found them to be extremely effective, like EMDR, somatic experiencing. But even finding a provider, someone who, a practitioner, is really difficult. And then having that covered by insurance is it does it just doesn't happen. Typically, you have to pay out of pocket, and then you have to hope that when you submit it to insurance that they pay some of it, if at all. And so, that's a problem, I feel like I've run into, which, I feel very fortunate and very privileged that, I was able to still get the care that I needed. But there's so many people around me who cannot. And what can we be doing? Do we need a lobby, the government to have all of this covered? What can we do? Because this is it is we're getting to a breaking point, especially after COVID. What can we do now?
In my research for teetering, I discovered through findings of Mental Health America that 50 million Americans have mental health issues. Somewhere around an additional 15 million are children. 50% of adults with mental illness do not get any treatment. That's 25 million people. 2 million kids had depression in this year, bad depression. So I want to add one other thing. This is worldwide. There are no countries that I know who do better for their people. So it's tough. We're having an epidemic. And the only way to help people is to get the insurance companies to do what they're out there for, and to get the government to up people's money. $20,000 is a drop in the bucket. And it just boils down to those two. And there's another thing. Because of the way the insurance pays the professionals, we're going to be 30,000 short of professionals by 2030. People are not, they wanted to go into psychiatry. They're changing their minds and going into something else. The psychiatrists of today, I'll tell you a little story. I went in the late 1990s to a very national, renowned psychiatrist out of Ohio. He was extremely good and made a lot of money. I mean, bunch of money. And the insurance companies came in and cut his residuals that they were paying him in half. One day I was in there because we'd gotten to be good friends, and I lived about 30 miles from him. And he says, "I'm going broke. Can you help me find a job?" Down, he was in the boonies, and I was near Columbus. He says, "You have any contacts where I can get a good job?" Couldn't help him. 2 years later, we went out of business.
Wow.
All because of the insurance companies.
Yeah.
This guy was brilliant. And in this country, we just turn our backs on it. There's 25 million people running around out there having a lot of problems. No way to help them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's why a lot of people in the mental health, mental health providers, they just, you have to pay out of pocket. Like they have no other choice. They don't take insurance. They can't deal with all of that. And, you know, like you said, and so now it's kind of up to us to pay out of pocket and submit to insurance and hope for the best.
Well, everything in the United States comes down to the people, because the government does what's good for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going on for thousands of years. People come at the whim of those in charge. We've got to stand up for this. And one reason I do these become guests on podcasts, and I've done about 40 of them, is hopefully people will hear what's going on, and somehow we can band together and become enough of a force that the government, the insurance companies, have to listen to us. In my mind, there's no other way. Mm-hmm. And that's going to take 50 years.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You know, that, you know, I do believe, yeah, that there is this massive hurdle when it comes to mental health insurance and trying to get the care. But I also want to touch back on the stigma, because for a lot of people, you know, I do this podcast. I talk to a lot of people about my own issues. And, you know, I feel like, you know, sharing your story, other people feel good about sharing their own story. And so they feel okay, feel better about seeking help, but then there's the insurance aspect. But there are still those who are kind of held back by the stigma of mental health. I feel like it's getting a lot better. I mean, I can't imagine what it was like when you were growing up at 9 years old and something like that happening to you. What can we do besides talk about it a lot more to dismantle the stigma for those who still aren't quite comfortable sharing their story? Because I do believe everyone experiences some sort of trauma that affect their mental health. And so many people are just kind of keeping it to themselves.
The stigma problem has always been there. And it's gotten better, but it's got a long way to go. You look at the media today, whenever there's a shooting, the guy was nuts. He was mentally ill. And that's not true. Maybe a few percentage of the time is true. So that makes things worse. And people who don't suffer from mental illness believe, because of they were told this all their lives, that these people who are mentally ill are inferior, they're crazy, but they don't realize that in every other way, these people, myself included, are normal. They just have a problem, like a broken leg, like having a heart attack, except those people get help. We don't. Now, there's another problem that we have, and that's the victims themselves of mental illness. They're, in many instances, keeping themselves from getting help because, one, they say, hell, there's nothing wrong with me. I can cut it out myself. So they never seek help. There are the ones who go to therapy. They get medication. Hopefully, they get some relief. It lasts for 6 months. And they go, hell, I don't need this medication anymore. I'm fine. So they throw away the medication. And a few weeks later, they go back down to the toilet. Then there's the group that won't take any medication. They'll go one-on-one therapy, but they're not going to take any medication. And I tell you, in my groups, I've pissed off a lot of people because we don't tell people what to do. We just give advice of what is out there and for them to choose from. I've had so many people who are anti-medication that when I bring up and the group brings up how medication is done for them, I've had people walk out of the room because they won't take medication. So there are a lot of people to blame on their own end, but that's just the way it is.
Do you believe that people can heal without medication?
No. That's my opinion. First of all, you got to understand that mental health is non-curable, especially clinical depression and bipolar disorder. I also think that we don't have the tools as individuals to get help on our own, meaning from our own actions. It's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've listened to some of my previous podcasts. I'm a huge psychedelic assisted therapy advocate. For me, like I mentioned earlier, you know, I was a childhood sexual abuse survivor. I was diagnosed bipolar in my mid-20s. 10 years later, I had been suicidal since I was a kid, since I was a teenager. since that had happened, the abuse. And I did a lot of, I think, the work that I did with EMDR and somatic experiencing and all of that work had helped me. And I do believe there's space for medication to kind of put out the fire. But I did, I my with my for after my first experience with psychedelic assisted therapy, which was, MDMA assisted therapy, I had to wean off my medications in order to do this journey. And as soon as I got done with the journey, which is it took about 4 or 5 hours, and I had weaned off of my SSRIs, which had been like about a month. And then once I got done with the actual journey and integration, I didn't have to go back on my medication. And to be honest, I haven't been on any medication. I mean, I was on ADHD medication since I was 13, maybe 12. And then, 20 something years later, 30 years later, I'm now not on any medication, which, so I feel like there are new modalities out there. And again, the problem with psychedelic assisted therapy is that it's not available to everyone. It's not legal to everyone. And the work that I did there, like, really changed my life, because I didn't know. I kind of understood, like, okay, I didn't want to be on medication. I just knew I had to be on medication. I was on lithium and Topamax, and I don't Trileptal, I think, was the medication I was on, and then Zoloft and Prozac and Adderall and Strattera, and now I'm glad to say that I've been doing extremely well, and my life has been transformed in a way that it hadn't been prior. And so I do disagree, and I know and I know that a lot of these medications, a lot of these new modalities aren't necessarily available, even though they're not so new. They were just kind of underground because the government had shut them down. But no, I'm just curious to know what your view is regarding that.
Before I go into that, what is psychedelic? Is that ketamine?
Ketamine is considered psychedelic. That is the legal version. That's only l really legal, and in my opinion, because you still need a lot of it. It's very expensive. Insurance isn't quite covering it, I don't believe, but it's a plethora. It's magic mushrooms, or psilocybin, which is the scientific name of the component in magic mushrooms, which is psilocybin. And then there's MDMA and LSD, and you probably heard of those things as very much like hallucinogenic, like drug users kind of drugs, but they're actually using a lot of it now to heal mental health. And typically trauma resistant, treatment resistant trauma. So they're doing a lot of work with it with veterans now.
Well, first of all, when I answered the question about can you do it on your own, I said no. I mean that. And when listening to you, I still say that because what you have done was not on your own.
Exactly. I guess it is, and I'm just I guess I was asking about medication.
Medication is great for people it works for, but it is a very unpredictable results. I was very lucky because I have a cocktail that I take of four medications that keep me stable. Would I ever do what you're doing? Maybe if it had been available 50 years ago.
It may be available soon.
But I
You
don't
should
need it now.
try
I don't need it. But
it.
I am not against any of that. If it works, great. So I would not say you people shouldn't do it. It's up to them. If they get relief, it's as good as medication. And I'll tell you this about medication. 50% of the people who try it get no relief. So there's 50% of people out there on their own because the medication will not work. There are various reasons. It makes them heavy. I've had people in my group gain 50 to 70 pounds on it, and they immediately, to a one of them, quit taking the pills because of the tremendous weight gain. So there are a lot of problems with medication. So again, I get back to saying if that psychedelic helped you, thank goodness.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, right? There's a lot of stuff, and I think, and I know it is hard for people who have a hard time taking medication daily, which I also had. I would have withdrawals with some of the medication I took if I didn't take them at the same hour the next day, which was really difficult. My hair was falling out. It was a whole mess. So I'm glad I found this alternative. And so I think if one medication isn't working, I mean it's good to look into to other things that may work for you. 'Cause once you give up, you give up, right? You should
Just to
find that
tell you
relief.
about one of my group members who took ketamine, which falls into the realm of what we're talking about. She had a reaction to the ketamine, and when they were treating her, she went psychedelic or psychotic, hit the nurse in the mouth. They had to tackle her down to the floor and restrain her. So what you're talking about still has its limits.
And
Gotta be careful with all that.
yes, absolutely. And you know, when it comes to and hopefully the FDA will approve all the other psychedelic drugs, but when they do approve it, it's gonna be psychedelic assisted therapy, in that there's gonna be work before to prep and work after, and you know, the medicine alone won't do it. It's the integration work that you do before and after, and so that will be a part of the protocol for these medications should they be approved, which many people are hoping for at the end of the year, because this is the kind of medication that veterans are seeking out now, that the studies have shown have been just astronomical in how they've been helping veterans with PTSD. And so, you know, it is a whole protocol. It's not medication alone. It's like for you, it's the support groups. It's integrating that work. It's discussing it. It's sharing. And I think that is ex what's extremely important in any of the healing that we're doing. It's hard to, like you said, it is hard to do it alone. And so I appreciate all of the work that you're doing with your facilitating your programs and helping so many people out. Is there anything that you would like to add?
The biggest reason that I do these podcasts after writing the book is, first of all, to let people know who are suffering is that they can have a good life if they follow what their doctors recommend or they do what you've done. If they just stick with it and do what they should do, they'll be fine. Now, will they be completely cured? Absolutely not. But they can still have a good life.
Absolutely.
After having gone through all this, and especially my groups where I've learned so much about how people suffer, we've got to get the word out to people that this is just as important as physical health. And we need to get things under control from the government and from the insurance companies. That is my goal, to help get it out. It's a long one. Long after I'm dead, you'll still be having the problem, but keep fighting.
Absolutely. Steve, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it and sharing your
Thank you.
story. Great. Well, that was Steve Wilson, author of Teetering on a Tightrope, My Bipolar Journey. For more information on Steve and where to purchase his book, just check out the show notes. April's issue of Authentic Insider is out. Check out Authentic Insider at traumasurvivorthriver.com. That's traumasurvivorthriver.com, as well as past episodes of a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to my email list to get Authentic Insider magazine in your inbox monthly. You've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. I'm Lori Lee Benstock. Thanks for being a part of the conversation. Take care.